This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, November 28, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Amid continued violence in the region, the trial against Saddam Hussein resumes in Baghdad today.
And I would also talk about the validity of this court, whether it is legitimate.
Farmers in South Korea are demonstrating, going to jail, and in some cases even committing suicide over the country's new rice bill. And Palestinians gain control of a major border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. European Union Justice Commissioner Franco Frattini announced today that any EU nation found to be hosting a CIA secret prison may have its voting rights suspended. Meanwhile, the U.S. is facing charges that it has been running a Guantanamo-like prison at an American military base in Kosovo. Jackson Allers reports from Pristina.
In an interview published last Friday in the French paper Le Monde, the Council of Europe's Human Rights Commissioner, Alvaro Gil Robles, said the detention center at Camp Bondsteel was, quote, a small version of Guantanamo Bay. Gil Robles visited the Bondsteel detention center in 2002 and came out publicly last week with his assessment in the wake of rumors that the Central Intelligence Agency had been operating secret detention centers in Eastern Europe, hiding and interrogating some of the most important al-Qaeda operatives in these so-called black sites. 3 weeks ago, the Council of Europe, a pan-European body that rules on human rights issues for its 46 member states, launched a probe into the allegations. Camp Bondsteel is a base operated exclusively by the U.S. military and hired security contractors. U.S. military officials deny Gil Robles' charge, saying no clandestine operations were being conducted at Bondsteel. Le Monde alleges that the prisoners held at the base had no access to a lawyer and did not fall under any legal jurisdiction. Although Gil Robles told the French Daily he had no evidence of a CIA link to Bondsteel, he asked Washington for official clarification. Reporting from Kosovo, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
In Britain, the Independent Police Complaints Commission has announced it's to investigate the conduct of Police Chief Sir Ian Blair over the shooting of an innocent Brazilian man by the Metropolitan Police Force in the days following the London bombings. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Brazilian electrician John Charles de Menezes was shot dead by police at Stockwell Station on July the 22nd after they mistook him for a suicide bomber. His family filed an official complaint with the Metropolitan Police. Aside from a governmental inquiry into the shooting itself, this will be a separate investigation into claims that the police chief misinformed the public after the shooting and tried to stop an independent police investigation into the matter. In a press conference on the day of the shooting, Police Chief Sir Ian Blair claimed that Mr. de Menezes' clothing and behaviour were suspicious. But according to information leaked from the Independent Police Complaints Commission, Mr. de Menezes had not in fact done anything to arouse suspicion, had not run from officers as was claimed, and had not been wearing a suspiciously bulky coat. The Commission's investigation is due to be completed by the end of December. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A United Nations conference on climate change opened today in Montreal, Canada, with thousands of delegates from approximately 190 countries in attendance. The meeting is the first major summit on climate since the Kyoto Protocol took effect earlier this year. The focus of the 12-day conference will be on greenhouse gas emissions. The conference is expected to discuss guidelines for the reduction of emissions after the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. The United States, the world's biggest polluter, has not ratified the treaty. Last week, European scientists published the conclusions of a study of Antarctic ice samples that revealed that atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide and methane are higher now than at any other time in the past 650,000 years. A massive benzene spill that poisoned the Songhua River is now approaching Russia. The toxic spill resulted from an explosion at a chemical factory in northeastern China 2 weeks ago. Running water was cut off for several days in the city of Harbin as the 50-mile-long slick of cancer-causing benzene passed by on the river. Although the water has been turned on in Harbin, authorities have advised that it is neither safe for drinking nor for bathing. Running water has been shut off in other Chinese villages. Russian towns further downstream are reportedly stockpiling water and activated carbon. Nepal's journalistic freedom was once again put to the test yesterday when police raided a radio station in the capital. Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad.
Nepal's radio Sagarmatha has been off the air since government officials raided the station last night. The station was reportedly closed down just before it was to rebroadcast a BBC interview with the leader of Nepal's Maoist insurgency. 5 of the station's staff members were arrested in the raid. King Gyanendra sacked Nepal's elected government in February and seized absolute power, saying that constitutional government was ineffective at combating the 10-year-old Maoist insurgency. Since his palace coup, heavy restrictions have been placed on the domestic media. Freedom of speech has been curtailed and scores of journalists have been arrested since February. It is illegal to broadcast news content on almost all of the radio stations in Nepal. This is the second radio station in Nepal to face government action. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Ben Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The trial of Saddam Hussein resumed today in Baghdad, and the testimony from the case's first witness was heard. Mitch Jezerich has the details.
After a 6-week break, the trial of the deposed Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein resumed in a specially built courthouse in the heavily fortified Green Zone of Baghdad. In exchanges with one of the 5 judges presiding, Saddam called on the judge to throw the U.S. out of Iraq.
I don't want you to pardon. I want you to order them. They are in our land. You have the sovereignty. You are an Iraqi, and they are foreigners and occupiers and invaders.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark was accepted as an advisor to Saddam Hussein's defense team. Clark, who was present in the courtroom, says he wants to ensure that Saddam gets a fair trial. Monday's hearing was the first since 2 other defense lawyers were murdered. Another international advisor to Hussein, Najib al-Naimi of Qatar, questioned the court's legitimacy.
The protection of the lawyers and the reasons why they're afraid to come here because of their security concerns. And I would also talk about the validity of this court, whether it is legitimate.
Saddam Hussein and 7 former Ba'athist officials are being tried for ordering the 1982 massacre of Shias in the town of Dujail, in which 148 people were killed after a failed assassination attempt against Hussein. The court heard the first testimony in the case today from former Ba'athist official Wada Azawi Ali, who has since died of cancer but whose affidavit was played on video. Azawi Ali investigated the attempted assassination of Hussein in 1982. In his testimony, he singled out an Iraqi intelligence official that called for the massacre.
Those who shot at the motorcade, no more than 12 people. And I wrote that down in my report that I gave to Barazan, and I don't know why they arrested that large number of citizens, and I had no role in their arrest. And I'd like to clarify also that after the accident, a number of people were killed in the farms by the security details of the defendant Saddam Hussein. And I heard after coming to the jail that those killed were related to one of the intelligence officers, Mohammed Mutaib.
The people of Dujail demonstrated today, calling on the court to execute Saddam Hussein. Trial has been adjourned until December 5th. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Palestinians gained control of one of their external borders for the first time this weekend as the border crossing between Gaza and Egypt opened to the public without the presence of Israeli soldiers. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas promised that this was the beginning and not the end, and that these steps would lead to a Palestinian state. But, as Iris Makler reports from the Gaza Strip, the political changes following Israel's withdrawal are yet to have any impact on the economic situation of most people in Gaza.
It's been chaos since the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt opened Saturday. The border's only open 4 hours a day, and hundreds of Palestinians have been crossing in both directions. Most are happy that for the first time since 1967, Israeli troops are no longer in control here. This Palestinian man came through standing on the back of a truck, punching the air with delight at reaching Gaza. But there are also complaints. There have been long delays for people leaving Gaza, including those going to Egypt for medical treatment. Taxis packed with passengers and piled high with luggage have been waiting for hours in the sun. The only people who've crossed so far are those with connections. The son of this one or the brother of that one, says this disgruntled passenger. At this terminal today, it's nepotism that rules. The Rafah crossing is now patrolled by Palestinian and Egyptian troops, supervised by European monitors. President Mahmoud Abbas says this is the first step towards Palestinian statehood. Controlling an external border has symbolic significance, and the increased freedom of movement for Palestinians who'd felt trapped inside Gaza is very real. But for ordinary people, very little has changed since Israel withdrew from Gaza 2.5 months ago. It's dawn at the Gaza seaport, and fisherman Rafat Bakr is coming in his family trawler. He says that Israel still imposes restrictions on how far out to sea Palestinian fishermen can go, even after it's pulled out of Gaza. The situation for fishermen will only improve if Israel stops limiting our access to the sea, he says. This night produced a good catch, 500 pounds of sardines, which sold locally for about $1,200. But after paying costs and splitting the profits with his cousins, Rafat Bakr's share is only $40. He says he can't support a family of nine on that money, and that his life has not improved since Israel pulled out of Gaza. Our lives are no better since Israel left. In fact, they're worse, says the Palestinian fisherman. Israel used to be an occupier, and therefore they are a bit more merciful, because we were part of their responsibility. There are plans to build a seaport here and to redevelop Gaza's airport after the runway was torn up by Israeli bulldozers almost 4 years ago. The G8 has promised $9 billion, spread over 3 years, for the redevelopment of the Gaza Strip. If that money is invested, it will have a far-reaching impact on the lives of everyone here. But that result depends on two things. First, the money reaching its target and not being siphoned off on the way by corrupt bureaucrats. And second, on Israel and the Palestinians being able to keep to the agreements they've reached about the free passage of goods and people between Gaza and the West Bank. Iris Makler, Free Speech Radio News, in the Gaza Strip.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. The National Assembly of South Korea ratified the rice bill on Friday, which will further expand its rice market. While some believe the move was an inevitable decision to avoid instant tariffs on rice, others claim that the government is selling out its agriculture for other industrial sector benefits. Before and after the ratification of the rice bill, South Korean farmers took to the streets to demonstrate against the bill. In protest, farmers burned rice grains almost daily in front of government buildings, saying they would rather die than be subjected to the bill's conditions. Two farmers have already killed themselves, and one died from wounds sustained by riot police, while several farmers remain in custody because of protesting. From Seoul, Korea, FSRN's Eunji Kang has more.
On Friday, the National Assembly of South Korea ratified the rice bill, which opens up the local rice market. During the APEC summit, more than 20,000 protesters were on hand with the front line consisting of farmers. In the past 2 weeks, two farmers have killed themselves in protest of the new trade deal.
Guarantee the right to live for 3.5 million farmers. We denounce forced process of the bill killing all the farmers.
Just after the ratification of the rice bill, Kwon Young-gil, chairman of the Democratic Labor Party, said, "To the last, today, the National Assembly of ROK sentenced 3.5 million farmers to the death." Kang Ki-gap is a congressman with the Democratic Labor Party. For 28 days, he was on a hunger strike against the ratification of the rice bill. Taking appeals from other members and comrades, he finally ended the hunger strike.
"I tried very hard to establish our agriculture as the industry for our health and life. But with this bill, our government showed it made agriculture a scapegoat to move forward to a trade-advanced country. That's why I continued my hunger strike, in spite of denunciations from outside. But I couldn't reject my colleagues' appeal to stop it. I really wish to tell all farmers that we should never lose our agriculture. We should survive and protect our agriculture to the end of our life. I will be with you always."
With the ratification of the rice bill, Korea is now obliged to raise its rice import quota to 7.96% of the total domestic consumption by 2014 from the current 4%. In return, it received a 10-year grace period for implementing tariffs on rice, a continuation of the 1994 WTO's Uruguay Round Agreement. Asia's fourth largest economy is also required to directly sell foreign rice at retail outlets, which opponents say threatens the competitiveness of homegrown rice. The staple grain from such countries as the United States and China is expected to hit local retail outlets between March and May. Farmers and some lawmakers have been adamantly claiming that the controversial bill will drive domestic farmers out of business. Park Ung-do is the political director of Korean Peasants League. He believes that there will be a collapse of the rice market.
"We already saw the rice price drop by 20%, even right before ratification. Importing rice will cause a fall of price of rice by 15 to 20%, and it will result in a total collapse of the rice market and rice agriculture."
Korea currently imports 225,000 tons of foreign rice a year for direct purchase by rice processing companies only. According to current standards, passage of the bill means 10% of the total would be available as stores for direct purchase by consumers. As a result, many farmers are worried about the future of Korean agriculture. They believe it is directly related to their own lives.
"I can only see that the government is trampling farmers. What can trampled farmers do? We only have struggles."
"The lives of people should be advanced before the national interest. Our constitution says the government should protect its people's property and life. Isn't it violation of the constitution for a government to abandon its people?"
"For our agriculture, for food sovereignty of 40 million people, for protection of rice all 70 million people can eat together, we will continue our struggle. I ask all of you to unite and struggle for new agricultural policy to come out to the last."
Although the South Korean government announced the development of a new agricultural policy, farmers are continuing the pressure. Last week, a farmer, Jeon Yong-chul, died of cerebral hemorrhage after he was seriously beaten by the riot police to his head. On November 13th, 2 days after a farmer, Jeong Yong-pum, killed himself after drinking agricultural chemicals in protest of the bill, a female farmer, Oh Chun-ok, killed herself at the same way and the same reason. Currently, dozens of farmers are in detention due to recent protests. The dispute around the opening rice market will continue for a while. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eun-ji Kang in Seoul, Korea.
In a recent visit to London, a leading Colombian human rights journalist raised awareness of press intimidation and censorship in the South American country, ravaged by 4 years of civil war, and called on the UK government to end its secretive aid program to the country. Helen Kelly reports on one man's struggle against the international powers of repression.
Well, working on human rights issues in Colombia is not an easy thing to do. Indeed, hundreds of human rights defenders have been threatened in recent years, and the best of these were assassinated 5 years ago, the best activists. Indeed, in May this year, I received death threats in the form of a wreath and flowers and an invitation to my own funeral.
Holman Morris, broadcaster and journalist, speaking in London on the risks of reporting human rights abuses in Colombia. Colombian journalists are frequently targeted for exposing government corruption. In 2003 alone, 12 journalists were killed, 12 kidnapped, 7 arrested, and 36 physically attacked. There have been no arrests and no prosecutions for these crimes. Morris believes the UK government's secret military aid program in Colombia is contributing to this climate of repression. Under the veil of a US-led anti-drugs campaign, the British government is believed to send millions of pounds of aid to Colombia each year. The vast majority of that aid program is classified. The exact value is unknown to both the public and to Parliament. Liam Craig Best from London-based lobby group Justice for Colombia claims there is evidence the aid may be contributing to human rights abuses.
It's going towards units in the Colombian military that are involved in counterinsurgency. For example, they bring Colombian soldiers to Britain, and the only place really, the main place they take them is to Northern Ireland for training courses in Northern Ireland. The units that are sent out to Colombia, the vast majority of them are SAS, which are special forces. Again, they would be experts in counterinsurgency.
Justice for Colombia, along with 200 British MPs, have tabled an early day motion calling for the UK government to freeze military aid until the human rights situation is resolved. As a measure of public concern, that motion works to pressure the government for greater transparency in its dealings with Colombia. The campaign has gained ground in recent weeks after Colombia's highest court cleared the way for hardline president Álvaro Uribe to run for a second term in May's general election. Colombia has not seen a president elected to two consecutive terms since the 1800s. Critics of the measure say re-election has a poor track record in the region, with second-term leaders often veering towards authoritarianism. Fair and transparent reporting of the election seems unlikely. Systematic violence against journalists has generated a culture of self-censorship, where journalists no longer report on corruption, the buying of votes, and intimidation. Amnesty International has been tracking the situation. Peter Drury from the Americas office has grave doubts on the quality of reporting.
Now, I think there are concerns. There are concerns, for example, that combatants and paramilitaries looking for their own candidates or threatening people to stand down. So are those threats going to be covered, for example, if they become public knowledge, or will they be banned?
Some voices refuse to be silenced. Like Holman Morris, and like the struggling Colombian communities he continues to report on.
We don't want military aid going to Colombia, not just from Britain, but from any other country, because we don't want any more war, so this is just perpetuating that. We want a negotiated, political, peaceful settlement to the conflict.
Helen Kelly, reporting from London, for Free Speech Radio News.
Dangerously high mold levels in New Orleans pose serious health risks, according to an environmental advocacy group who has collected air samples in the area. Despite this, doctors and aid workers say that many construction workers are not being adequately protected. FSRN's Christian Roseland reports from New Orleans.
I think that mold is the most acute health threat that we're facing. It's the one that people are dealing with now.
Gina Solomon is a researcher with the National Resource Defense Council, who took air samples whose results were released last week. NRDC found extremely high concentrations of toxic mold at locations in and around New Orleans. In one location, over 600,000 mold spores in a cubic yard of air inside a home. Solomon says that the government has let people in New Orleans down by not studying the possible health risks associated with this mold.
So far, we're the only group that has really done systematic mold monitoring in New Orleans. EPA is telling us that mold is an indoor air problem and that they have no authority over indoor air. This despite the fact that we found extraordinarily high mold levels in the outdoor air, which is clearly part of their purview. The other federal agencies are saying that this is something that needs to be dealt with by the state and local governments. And the state and local governments are telling us that they do not have the expertise to do anything about the mold problem.
Aid workers in New Orleans echo Solomon's concerns about the mold. Sharon Foley is an herbalist who came down from Michigan to help out at a first aid station at the Welcome Home kitchen. She says that her group has seen hundreds of people with upper respiratory problems, many of them construction workers, which she has been treating with herbal remedies.
It's really no joke. It gets all over you, and it gets on your skin, too. It's not just in the lungs. It's a sore throat. It's the sinus infection. It gets in your eyes. It just really... I mean, there's certain parts of town that people that have asthma shouldn't even drive near because it's so thick. As soon as you go into it, you can feel when you're hitting it.
Grassroots groups like hers and the Common Ground Clinic have been distributing emergency supplies, including safety gear for construction workers. She says that her group is filling a void in care.
Doesn't matter to me whether the construction people who are running the crews care enough for these people. We do. They come here. This is our supply everybody with whatever we can possibly give them to keep them safe. And so we supply them with the masks and show them how to put them on so that they get a nice seal. And we haven't had any protective eye gear, but we have it on our list for wishes. So we hope to get some.
Local doctors are also reporting more than usual amounts of upper respiratory ailments. Geraldine Menard is a doctor from Tulane Medical Center working at the nearby Covenant House Clinic, which treats many of the indigent in the area.
We have seen people who have been cleaning out their houses, so they do have a lot of the coughing and those cold symptoms. We've seen a lot of cough, a lot of upper respiratory symptoms, congestion, runny nose, and then this chronic coughing, which we have seen a lot of.
However, as far as the long-term effects of the mold, Menard and others point out that there is too little data, as health professionals have never dealt with this level of mold before.
We have, you know, people having symptoms, allergy-type symptoms, but what the long-term effects of it are going to be, I think it's too soon to tell. And these are the first studies that have come back, so we're just going to have to keep watching and treating people.
For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is Christian Roseland.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective produced out of Pacifica stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Washington editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can visit our website at fsrn.org. You can also email us at comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.